today on Ag News Daily.
Yeah, so the Swine Health Information Center was founded in 2015, really due to producers wanting an organization that focused completely on emerging disease threats to the U.S. swine industry.
Well, I'm still not sure what to do with my hands, Delaney, but I want to welcome the listeners back to the weekly edition of the Ag News Daily Show that you can watch on YouTube, social media, and make fun of whatever I need something to hold.
It's like Ron Burgundy. I don't know what to do with my hands.
You just keep getting higher and higher and higher.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I do know how to start our shows off, and we always start off with a little bit of weather. We talked about it a little bit earlier, but Canada is expecting a hotter than usual summer with slightly below average precipitation. So Central Canada, the government officials there said on Tuesday that this is offering little relief from the ongoing drought and is adding more risk to another bad wildfire season. Last year, Canada experienced the worst ever fire season with more than 6,600 blazes, ruining more than 15 million hectares and roughly seven times the annual average last year. Now, low snowfall throughout an abnormally warm winter and widespread drought is prompting the government to warn that April 2024 and beyond could potentially be another catastrophic year for fires. A drier week in the eastern half of their corn belt also coincided with some strong planting progress, like states in Indiana, Ohio, and Pennsylvania that Delaney is going to touch on here in a minute. The next 10 days may be the warmest week of the year for much of the corn belt, according to the National Weather Service and Climate Prediction Center. The most recent forecast, released June 10th, says areas from Nebraska to Kansas all the way to North Carolina have a high probability of higher than average temperatures. So it sounds like things are beginning to heat up, Delaney.
Sounds like we'll be getting some nice hot weather for Father's Day weekend, Tanner.
That's absolutely correct.
I'm just waiting for the dad jokes to be sprinkled in here throughout the show.
I'm going to hold on to them.
Well, as you mentioned, we saw a lot of that warm weather in the Corn Belt helped planting progress reach new milestones this week, now 95% complete nationwide as of Sunday, June 9th. That corn crop is 85% emerged, and conditions reflected 74% good to excellent conditions, down 1 point from the week prior. Soybean planting progress also moved ahead 9 percentage points, now 87% complete. 70% of soybeans have emerged as of June 9th, with 72% of that crop rated in good to excellent conditions. 89% of winter wheat has headed, and harvest progress is now underway with 12% complete as of Sunday, with the South quickly leading the charge. Meanwhile, Kansas is just getting winter wheat harvest underway, and 47% of the crop was rated good to excellent conditions, down 2 percentage points from the week prior. And lastly, as we look at spring wheat planting progress, it is now 98% complete with 87% of spring wheat emerged. Tanner, you guys finally planted?
Yes, we are. And I don't know if you can get more than 98% in one of these reports.
I know. I think we're probably about at the end here for those planting progress reports.
You're right. It has been a challenging start, though, agronomically to a lot of our listeners. So over the next few weeks, we'll continue to have the folks from Red Star Fertilizer dropping by with some items to consider and watch for this year. So here's another segment from them. Hey, listeners, it's time for a Red Star Daily Update. Our pleasure to have the crew here from Red Star Fertilizers, right? I've been saying just Red Star, but maybe I should expand the title a little bit to give us a little insight into this unique growing season. So guys, why don't you introduce yourself and what you do at the company, and we'll jump into that tidbit for the week.
Yeah, I'm Brody Benton, regional business manager, covering Iowa, Nebraska, Missouri.
Awesome.
Ryan Mullenoff, owner, with my wife in Lee, Nebraska.
Tom Stanton, I head up our Red Star branded business, which is our specialty fertilizer business. So I have the pleasure to work with these guys heading that up.
That's right. So we talked last time about the distinct difference in growing seasons, and we focused a lot on what the corn looks like. So I think it's time to give soybeans some sunlight.
They need some love, though.
They need a little bit of love. So why don't we dive into what it looks like?
Yeah. So, you know, on the soybean side, you know, same thing with corn. We got a lot of moisture. Soybeans really don't like wet feet. And so there's some unique challenges that we have this year compared to previous years. They also like more heat as well to really start growing above ground as well. So you know, how do we then start jump-starting that plant right now so we can then build that factory through the vegetative time frame so we have some carbohydrates when we get into that R1 stage? So,
I mean, we're looking at soybeans that were planted April 10th to soybeans that are yet to go in the ground probably June 10th, where I'll still be planting soybeans. And so we're going to have a very wide range this year of the beans that we're going to have. But I think what we want to try to do is focus on that, you know, V3, V4 timing through R1, because we really try to need to drive as much growth as we can here as we get into June to get that plant growing, right? Because beans are so sunlight sensitive, mm-hmm. we got to get them up and going. And a couple things that we're looking at to do that, and I'll talk about one of them and then kick it back to Brody, but we developed a product a couple of years ago called Red Shield. And Red Shield is a nice blend of phosphorus and potassium. And then we focused on, you know, boron, zinc, and manganese, because those three are always deficient when we look at corn and soybeans, especially vegetatively. And then we put something special in it, and we've talked about it before, Novastar, which is our polypeptide amino acid product. And so we've got the key things that soybeans need. You need potash, you need boron, and you need a little bit of a nitrogen source, which Novastar provides, just to help that plant to get up and get going. And right now, where we're so wet, the plant is struggling to pull nitrogen, and it's struggling to make those key amino acids, which turn into proteins. And so with Red Shield, it's a little bit like Brando from a few years back. It's kind of got everything that the soybean plant needs. And one of the key things is it's actually also going to help that plant to sort of fight off diseases as well. It's got something in it that really helps that plant with, it's what we call systemic acquired resistance, just kicks in its own natural immune system and just helps it, you know, become more of a fighter. And so I think something like that at 32 ounces this time of year would be perfect.
You know, that or the other option, you know, looks at that SunFed product that we talked about on corn, you know, last week, doing the same sort of things as far as influencing the size of leaf structure, above ground growth, creating sugars to be able to push those back down to the root exudates. And here's the beautiful thing is you're not tied into one product. You could do a combination of Red Shield and SunFed together and kind of get the best out of both worlds with those. You know, some other things that could also be considered, you know, definitely, especially with the C3 plant, sugar, right? So, you know, with the red sweet there, you know, spiking that in from a sugar source to continue to jumpstart that carbohydrate production. And also early on here, you know, soybeans are a C3 plant. They need carbon dioxide to create sugar. They are not like a corn plant that can convert O2, which takes more energy to convert O2 over to CO2, but still convert O2 over to CO2. They have to have carbon dioxide. And so where can we get that outside of our atmosphere? That's where we could cycle that from the soil and breaking down carbon. And that's where the biology comes into play that can go in this application as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you look at not just Iowa, where we're at today, but really Nebraska, Iowa, Missouri, Minnesota, South Dakota, Wisconsin, Illinois, dare I go any farther, we're all wet. And the sugar is such a key part, Brody, what you just said. You know, I always think back to Danny DeVito and the Snickers commercials. You know, corn and soybeans are hangry right now.
Right.
You know, they're suffering. They don't look great. They need a little food. Sugar, I mean, red sweet is just a real simple thing right now to put with anything you go foliar applied, just to give you energy. And, I think that's going to be critical here going forward the next 2 to 3 weeks.
So Ryan, as your crew is out in the fields helping farmers make some of these decisions, what are some early warning signs that you might need to start doing something?
Well, growth development, just look at the plant and look at how the color is. When it's pale, you can quickly tell that it's hurting, it's sick, it needs some energy, it needs a boost.
So if our listeners are looking for maybe some advice from your team, what's the best way for them to connect with Red Star?
Look us up on Facebook, Twitter, our website's redstarne.com or redstarbranded.com.
That's great. Gentlemen, thank you so much for bringing another segment to our audience. I look forward to what we get to talk about next week.
Thank you.
Lead. Well, there you go, Delaney, another valuable segment to help you navigate this growing season. So let us know if you want more of those. We're happy to have those folks stick around.
Absolutely. Great conversations you had here in the studio, Tanner. But switching our attention to avian influenza, multiple new cases have been reported as of this week, now totaling 12 states with confirmed reports. The first confirmed case has been added to a Minnesotan dairy farm, and a handful of cows in Benton County had symptoms over the weekend, and more than 40 cows had a fever the next day. Here in Iowa, the second case of avian influenza has been confirmed in a dairy in Sioux County, Iowa. Meanwhile, globally, a different strain of avian influenza, H7N9, has countries locking down their farms. Australia has now euthanized more than 500,000 birds, set up strict quarantine zones restricting birds' movements, and is starting to see other countries such as Japan and the U.S. temporarily banning poultry imports from this area in Australia as a safety precaution to consumers. The WHO also confirmed the first human case of H9N2 bird flu in a 4-year-old child in eastern India. Tanner, there are even some that are starting to call this a repeat of COVID-19, as the European Commission has gone as far as purchasing 665,000 vaccine doses targeting avian influenza for their population.
Wow, and here I was going to make fun of you saying Minnesotan, and that's a very serious piece of news.
It is.
Well, going back to Minnesota, we saw farmland values there increase by 2% in the past year, but cash rent rates decreased by a little less than 1%. Those were just some of the key takeaways from the recent agricultural economic outlook presented by Joe Mahon of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. Aglenders who were surveyed responded that farm income is down from over a year ago, and they anticipate this trend to continue for the second quarter of 2024. So far, high-quality farms have maintained relatively stable values. We also saw the recent report from Iowa State University with the cash rental rates survey come out for Iowa here in 2024. They found that overall cash rent averaged in the state at $279 per tillable acre in 2024. That's up from $222 an acre in 2020. The highest average came from District 1, which is the northwest corner of the state, at $304 on average. I still think those sound like some pretty high averages, Delaney.
They certainly do, especially considering the tighter economic conditions we are going to see for farmers this year. But kicking things over to today's conversation with Dr. Megan Niederwerder from the Swine Health Information Center, we caught up last week at the World Pork Expo about some potential and timely concerns for the hog industry. So let's turn it over to that conversation with Megan. So, Megan, you've just recently stepped into the role as executive director now, but you're no stranger to SCHIC. Tell us a little bit about your background and story that led you to SCHIC and where you are today.
Yeah, so the Swine Health Information Center, of course, is focused on mitigating the risk of emerging disease. And my history is that I served as a veterinarian, practiced in clinical practice for 3 years prior to obtaining a PhD in swine virology. And so viral diseases that affect pigs, including African swine fever virus, PRRS virus, PCV2. I served as a faculty member at Kansas State University for 6 years and then came to work for the Swine Health Information Center in April of 2022 and just recently took on the role as executive director. So certainly excited to be in this role and continue on this work of mitigating emerging diseases of swine.
Well, I've heard you have a really impressive and extensive background in livestock and animal science research. So I'm excited to dig more in and learn how that path has brought you to doing some of the research that SCHIC is doing today. But for those of our viewers who are unfamiliar with SCHIC, give us the 10,000-foot overview of what the organization does.
Yeah, so the Swine Health Information Center was founded in 2015, really due to producers wanting an organization that focused completely on emerging disease threats to the U.S. swine industry. It was really founded because of the introduction of porcine epidemic diarrhea virus in 2013. And so this was 2 years later, and producers wanted an organization, again, to focus on what else is out there, what's on the horizon, how can we mitigate any emerging disease risk that's either in the U.S. or globally. And so the Swine Health Information Center is funded by the Pork Checkoff. Those dollars are utilized for domestic and global disease monitoring. We also have coordinated communications where we try and inform producers on any risks. And we also have targeted research investments looking at how do we mitigate the next emerging disease risk? How do we prevent introduction? How do we ensure that we have the diagnostic tests in place for accurate and early detection? And thinking about how do we protect our pigs, really try and enhance the health of the U.S. swine herd.
When you look at the myriad of potential foreign animal diseases that may hit U.S. shores, where are the areas where SCHIC is most focused right now from a research R&D perspective?
Yeah, certainly African swine fever virus has to come to mind, thinking about where it is globally. Anytime it's introduced into a new country or region or there's an outbreak, we include that on our global disease monitoring report, trying to inform producers, animal caretakers, veterinarians, what the virus is doing globally, how it's changing, how it's impacting herds, and certainly where it's located. The other virus we've really been doing a lot of research on lately is Japanese encephalitis virus. It's a mosquito-borne virus that affects reproductive sows. And so thinking about reproductive outcomes like mummified fetuses, abortions, stillbirths, delayed farrowing. There was an outbreak in Australia that occurred in 2022. It expanded its geographic range, and there was a new genotype. And so certainly that raised the level of alarm for U.S. producers thinking about how do we prevent introduction? How has the risk changed? Again, we are negative for JEV, but certainly want to have research impacts to prevent any introduction and mitigate that risk.
Okay, Megan, so let's take this from a producer standpoint here for a second. We've talked a lot about maybe what SCHIC's focuses are, but how are you taking those focuses of those foreign animal diseases you just mentioned, African swine fever, et cetera, and translating that research into something that a producer sitting at home watching or listening to this may be able to start doing on their operation or understanding how those dots all get connected?
Yes. A good example of that is our Wean to Harvest Biosecurity Research Program. This is a program that we founded with the Foundation for Food and Agriculture Research and the National Pork Board, trying to leverage funds. We had a $2.3 million program that to date has funded 18 different projects. Wow. So it's looking at how do we have bioexclusion, preventing pathogen entry, but also biocontainment. So if your herd breaks, how do you prevent your neighbor or another farm down the road from becoming infected? And then thinking about the transport aspect of biosecurity, how do we protect our pigs from the transportation biosecurity from farm to farm, from farm to market, and thinking about how we do that in novel ways. And so one of the most interesting research projects that's recently been completed is looking at how do we motivate our personnel and how do we think about enhancing compliance of biosecurity practices. We spend a lot of time training our personnel, but not as much time looking at how do we motivate them for consistent compliance on a day-to-day operation. So one of the outcomes of this research was to look at it seems like an opportunity for us on our swine operations is to provide rewards, supervisor support, and performance feedback for those personnel who are consistently completing those biosecurity protocols. Really thinking about providing that feedback to our personnel. You're doing a great job. This is exactly how we want you to perform the biosecurity protocols, and consistently giving that feedback.
So when you were looking at those motivations of what really encouraged personnel not only to get trained, understand the importance, but then translating into doing that themselves, how many different personnel did you talk to, and what was kind of that end result after maybe testing some different motivational incentives that you could use on a farm level?
Yes. So it was a survey of 139 animal caretakers across 5 production systems. And the survey included quantitative response, so like a 1 through 5 response of what their job demands were, what the job resources that were provided, the level of exhaustion that they had, or if they were disengaged from their work, thinking about what the social norm was. So if their coworker was also performing the biosecurity protocols, how would that impact them? And so the results from that survey really, again, looked at that supervisor support and providing feedback to our animal caretakers as an opportunity to motivate them and to make them feel good about their day-to-day completion of those biosecurity protocols, certainly an area that is in supplementation to the training aspect.
Were there any results from that survey that surprised you after going back through them?
Well, I think one of the things is that it's not just about caretaker motivation. It's really about that interaction and feedback and providing that incentive and good rewards for completing those biosecurity practices. We also want to simplify biosecurity practices. If it's too complex, again, as those personnel are completing them, if it gets too complex, again, that just enhances the likelihood that it's not going to be completed as written. And so simplifying it talking to animal caretakers about why it's important, why endemic disease and prevention of that is really important for pig health. And animal caretakers inherently care about these animals. And so, again, utilizing that to reward them for performance of biosecurity.
So what are some of the other maybe top research projects you're focused on right now? We mentioned the personnel one, the wean to harvest. What are some other top studies you guys are focused on here moving forward?
Yes, the Japanese encephalitis virus research projects are underway. And also we continue to fund Japanese encephalitis virus, a mosquito-borne disease. So we're looking at what's the most effective mosquito control measures that producers can put in place. How would we develop a surveillance program? And what are the areas in the U.S. that may be at highest risk? We just recently completed a risk assessment for Japanese encephalitis virus introduction, and it looked at different regions of the U.S., what region may be at highest risk. And what they were able to identify is those southeast states, essentially from Texas to Virginia, those southeast states were at highest risk for introduction because of the seaports and the airports that are receiving goods from countries that have Japanese encephalitis virus. So that may be an adult mosquito that may be infected and may be transported along with some goods. Thinking about where the feral swine are, of course, they're at risk for Japanese encephalitis virus as well. And so that area is really identified as the focus area for potential surveillance program. As we learn more and more, again, we can put these practices in place to understand how would we detect it if it's been introduced and how do we mitigate it.
Megan, I appreciate your time today. If any of our viewers or listeners would like to check out some of Schick's resources, the personnel study that you mentioned, where is the best place to go to find out more information?
Yes, all this information is on our website, swinehealth.org. And we also put out a monthly newsletter, so if anyone is interested in receiving that on our website, you can sign up for our newsletter that comes in once a month. It includes the domestic disease monitoring report, the global disease monitoring report, and then any research results, so you can stay up to date on anything that we have going on.
Perfect. I didn't know about the newsletter, so I will be signing up for that myself.
Great.
Megan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, I thought Megan did a great job of breaking down all of those big topics. I still don't think I could pronounce the Japanese swine disease that she mentioned.
No, that's right. How about markets this week?
Well, this week we saw the June WASDE report released, and it did little to excite the grain markets. Despite analysts' expectations for a lower corn ending stocks number, the USDA held strong, with ending stocks or leaving those unchanged, while soybean ending stocks were increased more than the trade expected. Looking globally, the USDA reduced their Brazilian soybean harvest expectation by 1 million metric tons, but left corn unchanged. They also left corn and soybean production for Argentina unchanged as well. We also saw USDA cut Russia's wheat crop by 5 million metric tons to now 83 million metric tons, as well as a cut to Ukraine's production by 1.5 million metric tons.
Yeah, that's right, Delaney. Russia has declared a state of emergency in their ag sector of the southern Rostov region due to their ongoing drought conditions. The emergency, effective immediately, aims to address the potential crop losses estimated at up to 30% following earlier damage from May frosts. The Russian Ministry of Agriculture so far estimates the crop losses from May frosts at about 1 million hectares, or 1.2% of the total sown area for the 2024 harvest, and another 700,000 hectares suffering damage. Most of the dead crops have already been reseeded, according to the ministry. The USDA raised its pork production forecast by 40 million pounds, noting more rapid pace in the second quarter slaughter and higher dressed weights. Pork production is expected to rise 2.9% from last year, and pork exports are now forecasted to rise 8% from the year before. USDA lowered its 2024 average cash hog price projection by $1.25 to $61.24. Beef production for 24 was left unchanged with just over 26.5 billion pounds. So a lot of movement, it feels like, in the livestock side, with not a lot of changes on the crop side.
That's right. But we're going to be chatting markets on the podcast next week for a little change up in our market discussion, Tanner. So
I can't wait for that interview, because we're bringing back some old friends. Thanks to you for being longtime listeners of Ag News Daily. You're going to recognize this guest. And I'm pretty sure I'm going to start off with letting her know she's an old friend, and not just a friend for a long time, maybe just because she's old. I don't think that's going to go over very well.
If that was a dad joke, it was...
No, I literally was thinking about doing that. Like, I look forward to that conversation because she's very insightful.
Very.
And doesn't sugarcoat things. We'll get definitely a really good pulse on the markets.
We certainly will, Tanner. But do you have any dad jokes for us to wrap up the show today?
I really don't. I was thinking about that, but these headlines really grabbed most of my attention today. I may have to come up with some that I can tag on social media. And this is a good opportunity for you as listeners. Make sure you send us your dad joke, so that way we might be able to air it next Friday.
That sounds good, Tanner. Well, with that, should we let the listeners go?
Let's let them go.